Today is Wednesday. It's July 31st, 2024. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. You've done it again. You found the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for joining us. Share us with your friends. Listen to us some Saturday nights on WGN at 8 o'clock. And you can catch my show weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin, an award-winning journalist and communications consultant. I have a few decades of political experience. I draw on as a pundit, currently featured on Canada's CTV, and an all-around expert at challenging authority.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist. No awards. Now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I was the rookie of the year on my junior college basketball team.
Awesome.
I'm sure, Kate, if we go back far enough, we'll be able to find something.
Well, when I was in first grade, I was picked to bring up a little like wreath on a particular holy day honoring the Virgin Mary, but I got sick that day and I didn't.
Aww.
Austin, any other awards you'd like to share with the class?
No, I don't. I did have a funny, we just put shelves up in this office that I've been neglecting for a year since we moved, and you have to pick what kind of, you know, stuff goes on these shelves. And so I was rummaging around to find awards. So there's various awards there.
Wow. Oh, now I see them. Yeah. One of those is a Lissiger Award, if I'm not mistaken. The most prestigious award that you can get for Chicago journalism.
Yeah. That was when I was doing more sort of photojournalism work a few years ago. But that was very exciting. And I think Illinois Policy Institute the next year was banned from competing in the Lissiger Awards. So I got in like under the wire.
Because you won too many? Is that it? It was such a sweet.
Yeah, because we were too good.
No, I don't know. You need a category of your own.
People have a chance, right?
Yeah, give the rest of us a turn. Okay, well, speaking of journalism, I don't usually resort to name-calling, guys, but one version of an old saying I saw today is, don't blame a clown for acting like a clown if you keep going to the circus. Just a couple of hours ago, Donald Trump took the stage here in Chicago at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention, and it was a circus. Rachel Scott, the senior congressional correspondent for ABC News, Harris Faulkner, a newscaster and program host at Fox News, and Kadia Goba, a political reporter for the online publication Semaphore, sat on a stage with Donald Trump and peppered him with questions. Scott asked, given his history of racially insensitive speech, this was right out of the gates, and she mentioned the fact that he has previously dined with white supremacists at Mar-a-Lago. Why should black voters trust or vote for him? Trump responded with, what a horrible way to start. No, hello, how are you? And aren't you with ABC? He said, because they're a fake, terrible news network. The crux.
Although she did welcome him and say thanks for being here.
She did get that. But I also thought, who are we kidding here? Let's dispense with the platitudes. We've only got an hour. It turned out to be less than an hour. But the crux of the question was not to plow old ground. Trump's responses were predictable. But rather to address this question, should he even be invited to an event like this? She said, Mr. Trump, as you know, there's some people that don't think you should be here. And I think that's a good question, but I sure have my answer to that, and it is, yes, he should be. Our Brandon Pope, who joins us regularly on this podcast, was there and has been told he can't speak for the organization and is not to come on this podcast, at least not this week. Austin, what's your response to that? Was it a bad idea for the NAJB, the black journalist, to invite Trump to speak?
Well, yeah, I should say Brandon, he would say this if he was on. He's the head of the Chicago chapter of the NABJ. Yeah. And I believe the national, you know, umbrella group was sort of the ones pulling the strings in terms of who was invited or not.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Brandon had to deal with a lot of stray bullets over the last few days as someone who wasn't involved in that decision. But I think it's entirely appropriate for an association of black journalists or any association of journalists to invite the two leading candidates for president to speak to them, as they have in previous years and continued to do this year. I thought it was interesting that I believe it was Nicole Hannah Jones said, famously, the 1619 Project in the New York Times said that he is a unique candidate and thus should not be invited to something like this. Probably Trump put Kamala in a bit of a trick box with this. And the fact that she didn't show up to an event like this and he did makes it very, very difficult for them to claim, you know, Trump is sort of the anti-black candidate and Kamala is the pro-black candidate. Like, he did show up. You got to give him credit for that. He showed up to what was a pretty tough conversation and gave answers. I think the most notable one was his comments around Kamala, whether she was in, she was formerly focused on her Indian heritage, and then she, I can't remember the quote, but turned into or became a black person. And there was like, it was a, I've never heard a noise like this. It was like a gasp and a laugh line from the room because it was so kind of over the top. And I, in any event, I do think he's probably getting in front of a lot of black voters who otherwise he wouldn't be in front of. So I think it was probably smart of him to attend.
Okay. So, okay for them to invite him, not inappropriate. And yeah, also he probably comes out ahead, even knowing as you do what he said and how he behaved. You think this is a win for Trump?
Well, I mean, the bar is on the floor in terms of Republican performance with black voters. So it's hard to go, you know, lower. So having attention and maybe even getting a more positive response from even just a small number of black voters who might not otherwise have seen him in that kind of setting, I think probably if you're doing political calculus for Trump, that's probably a good thing.
Although since there is a woman of color, a woman who identifies as black on the other side, I do wonder if his dismissal of them, his conduct, actually transfers votes or generates votes for Kamala Harris. What do you think of that, Marge?
I agree that he should be invited. I disagree that it was a net plus for him. The idea, did you say, Austin, that he looks like the pro-black candidate?
No. It's difficult to say that he's anti-black in that context when he showed up to the event. I'm not saying
except,
Trump is pro-black.
Right. Candidate. That was, I think, the plan, except that everything he said was anti-black. He doubled down on this idea that immigrants are taking black jobs. They called him on it and they said, what are black jobs? Said, well, they're, you know, a black person who has a job, like you. And a lot of people in this room are probably black. He wouldn't even concede that everyone in the room was black. And and then he doubled down on the black job concept. And he said, but immigrants are taking them. They're illegals. And he went again on the illegal nomenclature. Of course, I don't endorse that. But he went on to say they're sending us, you know, rapists and open the mental institutions. They're flooding the borders, tens of millions. He makes up all these numbers and he makes all this stuff up. But he was circling around some very racist language. He can't read the room. And I think that's going to hurt him. The idea, what you brought up, the thing about him challenging whether Kamala Harris is black or not, it was an astounding thing to say. And actually, he got so worked up himself, he actually mistakenly pronounced her name correctly once.
I don't know how you feel about this, Kate, but I think the issue of your ethnicity or your color, isn't it the color of your skin by which people will sometimes judge you and discriminate you against you? So if you have her coloration, then I really don't care where your parents are from. I think you suffer the consequences of having that color. I understand the sort of discrepancy at play here, but I don't think it matters. It doesn't matter your heritage so much if you're talking about discriminatory treatment as it is how do people see you. And she presents as a black person. So to me, that's the end of the discussion.
I think it does matter in the sense of that if you've talked to any African immigrant to the United States, you will say that in some parts of the black community, they are treated differently than a black American who has a legacy
yeah.
of black ancestors in the United States.
Right.
So I think in the same way, certainly there are people who feel like, well, just because you have darker skin, it doesn't necessarily mean that you share the same quote unquote black experience as other members of the black community. I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
You might judge it by whether she's likely to get pulled over as a black person or not. And I think that's a risk she runs if she's by herself behind the wheel and not recognized the way she is today.
I was just thinking that Austin's very nuanced observations here are probably not what Donald Trump meant for people to understand. it's good that you got that out there nonetheless. What I thought perhaps was very interesting about the whole kerfuffle was that it is basically bringing out a general division in the journalism community that's been especially out there since Trump's first campaign, in terms of whether it's right to quote unquote platform people like Trump, which kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of whether or not we should have quote unquote objective reporting. So a lot of people who were against Trump being at the convention today, that was how they put it, that they should not have been platforming him. Obviously, that is for the wider membership to finish making up their minds about. Maybe after this, they're going to be really mad and they're going to vote out all the people who were in charge of
this.
The
co-chair of the event stepped down.
One of the co-chairs, yes. But the president of the organization, Ken Lemon, did a wonderful defense of the whole thing, which he tweeted out a video of himself talking to some young and some student journalists who were asking him about it. And he made the point, it's not an endorsement. As a journalistic organization, of course, you're not endorsing people when you interview people. However, they did specifically say it's not an endorsement, and they do this for every single election cycle. So they weren't about to skip having an opportunity to actually be able to personally vet and grill one of the candidates for president in front of their own members. And he made the point, you know, I personally, he said, I have interviewed KKK members who were running for office. That is what being a reporter is about, having uncomfortable conversations, being in uncomfortable places. And it was just really a wonderful defense of the whole thing, which I completely agreed with. When you say platforming somebody, that would be letting them get up on stage and Trump making a stump speech. It's not what it is when a journalist interviews you, and certainly not when you get three journalists up there really grilling him.
And those weren't softballs. You're right. Even Harris Faulkner, who is quite capable of tossing him softballs, she has before from Fox News. That thing was sharp, but in hindsight, almost predictable too. Like, they'll ask tough questions, they'll try and follow up, they're going to talk over each other, and he's just going to do the Trump show. And I think that I'm with you, Kate. I think that journalists shouldn't take sides, and not inviting him is taking a side. So
it is. And it's depriving your audience of actually reporting reality.
And it's up to us to decide what to do with his answers, so that this is an advocacy. If he comes out ahead because of this, then that's up to the voters to decide. And if he goes down even lower, that's up to the voters to decide. You know, he does it at his own peril. You wonder almost how calculated Donald Trump is in a situation like that. I'm going before black journalists. I'm going to need to get big cities like the suburbs of Detroit or outside of Minneapolis or outside of Columbus. I'm going to need to find voters here. So I wonder if I can spin this to try and just pull in a few more votes. It didn't seem like he was thinking about that at all. He was just doing the Donald Trump show. Voters beware.
You know, to be fair, that's what all politicians do, though. And that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're there for. Any politician that they did have, and that would include Kamala Harris, would be there to, as well as she could, get around the questions asked and give the answer that she wants to give. That's what they do. And so fine. It's reporters try to get as much as they can out of them. And the more that they can, the more interesting it is. And I thought they did a terrific job today, as well as anybody could have.
But what he does that other politicians don't do, he's not disciplined. He didn't stick with his own talking points. He went off on his grievances. One of the first things he said was, "You made me wait 35 minutes. It's very disrespectful." And then when they would cut him off, they had problems with the equipment. And he said, well, you don't have people who know how to work equipment here, so that's not my problem. He went on and on about the delay. And then when they cut him off and said, really, we have limited time, he said, yeah, but you wasted 30 minutes of my time, so I'm going to keep talking. Like his grievance thing he put forward, he could not control himself. He went off on tangents and on themes that I wouldn't think were chosen for this audience. I think
that was one of the great things about having him there. Having
an
appearance like that, he showed himself for who he is.
Of course, but my point is, he wasn't like
pretty much for worse. But the audience, and now their audience, got to see that, and they're going to hear about it.
Yes, I think he belonged there. But my point is, he's not like every other politician. He did not respond to the questions that were given. I think it's good that we could see that. I think it's good that audience could see it. I think he tried unsuccessfully to defend Vance's comments about women. And he said, well, he likes family. He supports family. But, you know, if you grow old and you never found that right person, well, you know, I respect you anyway.
I took away from that, though, Marge, a couple of points, for instance, on that. He said, essentially, in a very roundabout way, that he did not agree with Vance about the fact that if you are childless, you have less rights, should pay more in taxes, or get fewer votes. They asked him about that specifically, and he didn't seem to know a lot about that, but he said that that wasn't his own view. I wonder if that's not going to resonate now. So it's not like the vice president sets the policy for the team, but clearly the two of them are in different places on some of those issues, right?
Yes. And also, you know, the cliche is real. He's a heartbeat away from running the country if their team is elected. And it's a rather weak heartbeat, apparently, because he's the oldest nominee now.
They tried to turn him on that, too.
They did. It didn't work.
And so, if, for instance, in that, when they said, if you're reelected, you will be 82 as president, which is older than Joe Biden is. And he says, yeah, but he's shot. He's no good now. And that was another instance where the crowd laughed. And we'll have to wait to hear from Brandon or some of the journalists who were there. But it was a kind of a raucous, laughing crowd. And Austin, I did not know how to interpret that. I didn't know what that laughter meant.
It's hard, and really, like, that, you know, kind of reading the room and saying, you guys, you know, well, what a nice welcome. And like, this equipment's not working. I mean, it is, he gets very fixated on, ever since, I mean, the rallies in 2016, on the room and the energy of the room, and trying to lean into where the laughs are in the room. And he was certainly trying to do that there. And watching him do that in uncomfortable environments is just, I mean, regardless of whether you agree with what he's saying or not, very interesting in terms of public speaking. And you saw a similar dynamic when he spoke to the Libertarian Party National Convention, where many people in the audience really did not like Trump. And they were even, you know, openly booing many things that he would say. And he would immediately, I mean, it's like a stand-up comedian getting heckled or something, go back with, well, you know, keep booing, you know, I think you should vote for me, but only if you want to win. Don't vote for me. You can keep getting your 5%. Vote for me only if you want to win. You know, like, and he would do these lines, and he would get laughs on them from a hostile crowd. And I haven't watched the full interview yet, but I'm curious to see how that dynamic played out.
A colleague suggested to me that they were laughing at him, not with him. I can't tell the difference. I couldn't tell the difference. But it played on the radio as Trump winning.
Interesting, because he was saying things that were so blatantly lies. I think that they were laughing because of the absurdity of what he was saying. Is how
there was a lot of that. I agree, Mark.
He went on and on about the late term abortions, that term that Republicans made up because they don't exist. And the interviewer said, no, that's not true. That's one of the few times they verbally fact checked him. They have a fact check website linked to their Facebook page, the NABJ, and you should take a look at it because it's a long list of corrections. That's one of the few that they verbally corrected him on. And he went on, no, that's what they do. They birth the baby. The doctor looks at him and says, well, should we kill it? And then maybe they kill it.
I thought they'd rather let him get away with that. I guess what's the point of arguing everything that comes out of the guy's mouth? As I said a moment ago, the viewers decide. Let the voters decide, you know, what to do with this. One of the reasons I heard that the event event started so late here in Chicago was not because of technical difficulties. Marianne Ahern tweeted out that it was because there was a disagreement. He wasn't going to come out at all because they said they were going to live fact check what he said. Maybe they were doing it online.
They were.
And then I guess the journalist could have followed along in the room, or you could go mm-hmm. back to the site. I guess that would be the value of it.
He claimed that he was told that it was a debate, that Harris would be there. I don't think that could be true, because everything I'm reading in the media says they invited her, she wouldn't come. She wanted to be virtual, and they said no. He said he wanted to be virtual on Zoom, and they wouldn't let him, but now they're going to let Kamala Harris be on Zoom, and that's patently unfair. None of that is true. I mean, he, as far as I know, from reading the accounts that they've given in the quotes. And I just, you know, it's an interesting question you raise at the end, not intending it to be a question maybe, but how do you interview somebody who's just a fire hose of lies? Is it okay to let the audience hear when you sit there in front of him and know it's a lie and let it go? I feel like you need to be dedicated to the truth, and yet you're right, it just will bog down. How should he be interviewed in this situation? No,
I think they did it just the way you have to do it. They challenged him on everything, Marge. But, you know, after you've gone through it three or four times on one particular point, and you've made the point that he's wrong and he's lying about something, then you let it go and you go on to another topic. You've made it clear to the audience that what he is saying is not necessarily correct. And at that point, we as reporters do need to trust that the audience is intelligent enough to understand that kind of conversation.
And the voters as well. I do think, though, that at a debate, I would use this strategy. And I don't think it would be inappropriate for a reporter to, if you've gone far enough with the line of questioning and you're not getting a truthful answer, to say, okay, but for the audience's sake, what this man just said is not true. Now we're going to ask another question and see what he has to say. And at least I can process it that way. There's also some people that I would not invite. I wouldn't have invited RFK Jr. Kate, I would not have platformed RFK Jr. there. I think that is giving him more opportunity than he deserves. Is that what I mean? You've got to respect the fact that Trump went to that event and that he sat there even without Kamala Harris. He said, okay, bring it. I'll give you what I got. You got the full measure of the man, and that is better than dodging. I respect that he went there. When John Anderson was running for president, he went to an NRA convention and spoke to them, and he was not on their side at all. What does he think he's going to do? Convince them? But you've got to respect that. If the head of the Teamsters goes to the RNC, I respect both sides for having that dialogue. So I'm not against Trump being there. I would have expected that it would have gone like it did, and it's up to the voters to interpret what happened.
I mean, I totally agree with you. As far as, you know, inviting someone like RFK Jr., and I wouldn't say platform, because a journalism convention is never going to just platform someone. They're going to interview them and not just let them make a speech. But I assume that just like with the debates, that they have certain metrics in place for who is a major enough candidate to deserve to be invited. And probably they have, of course, a number that's at least around where the debate number was. Was that 15 or 20%? I forget. But RFK Jr.
Or do you have enough delegates to win? So, there's no point in giving somebody the stage if they can't technically win, if they're not on enough ballots.
Right. In this case, it was supposed to just be the major party nominees.
Be interesting to see what Brandon Pope has to say the next time he joins us, because he was sitting there, and hopefully he'll give us a better insight into that room. Just speaking of things presidential, what would your advice be to Kamala Harris for a vice presidential pick? Assuming that she does get the nomination, then who does she pick? And we notice that next Tuesday, I think it is, she's going to be making an appearance in Philadelphia. Huh. So do you think it's Shapiro? Every time I hear the governor of Minnesota speak, I think he could carry some states or votes, but Minnesota's not so much in play as Arizona. And Mark Kelly seems to have a good line. Marge, who's your advice to Kamala Harris? Who should she pick?
Mark Kelly. That's my vote. And I know that that means vacating a Senate seat, but not right away. The governor will replace him. He's got two more years in his term. And by then, party in place, he'll have the new appointee will have incumbency. And you got to roll the dice on that, because right now you need the strongest candidate that you can get. And I think it's him. I think he can help in Arizona. I think Shapiro and Pritzker, for that matter. I'm very uneasy about adding a Jewish candidate to the ticket. And it pains me to say that. We've talked about my own Jewish heritage on this show more than once. It's not an entirely comfortable time to be Jewish in this country. The vice president's married to a Jewish man. And I feel that if she adds Shapiro, who, by the way, calls himself a Zionist and takes a pretty hard line, she will reignite the whole Gaza debate. And we don't need that right now for the Democratic Party. So I think it's great she's in Philadelphia. He campaigns with her and he's an impressive advocate for her. And I think that's the position he should stay in.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on that, Marge. It's really wrong, obviously, that Shapiro is not the strategic person to pick right now. He's great in so many other ways. And obviously, Pennsylvania is like the key state and he's popular there. But she is really going to have to work to win over, for instance, the Muslim majority areas in Dearborn, Michigan, because I really don't know how she is going to completely distinguish herself from President Biden's approach to Gaza and still do that, because many of the people who are Gaza protesters are not happy with a two-state solution. Saying that you're for a two-state solution and that you want a ceasefire is not necessarily enough. To pick someone like Shapiro, who very, as you say, has identified himself as a Zionist and came out very early on against the Gaza protests, it obviously, you know, you don't even have to inflame that. It's already inflamed. We can only imagine what the DNC protests will look like if she does pick Shapiro. The main thing is it's not going to help her win. And if that's what they want to do, Kelly is definitely the way to go.
I think, just on the pure political calculus, you can win. Your odds of winning Pennsylvania go up so much by picking Shapiro. And the only reasons not to do it are the ones that were just mentioned, which is, do you want to make support for Israel a major issue on the left in this campaign? One quick note on that. That may be still the case. I mean, I think Kamala is sort of in a grace period right now. Those same protesters, I think, will want her to be more vocal about what her position is on that, regardless of who the vice president is. So that could continue to ratchet up if she doesn't make her stance clear. But the other thing about Shapiro is that he was very pro-school choice in Pennsylvania, and teachers unions and Randy Weingarten are not wanting a Josh Shapiro vice president pick just for that reason. And that's a very powerful constituency in the Democratic Party. So I think that's another reason why, if it's not Shapiro, I do think it will be. But if it's not, that would be another reason why.
Thanks for the intel.
Although it's interesting, too, like we're pretending that the policies or beliefs of the vice president or the faith somehow changes the presidency or laws, right? Like, since when did what Al Gore felt or Kamala Harris felt or Dan Quayle felt, when did those things matter so much? But right now, we're giving them a lot of weight.
Well, this election in a thousand ways is unlike any other, right? So we keep using this unprecedented, you know, phrase, but this is a marginal election. And that means a tiny percent is going to decide those swing states. What was Wisconsin was decided by 11,000 votes in 2020. Michigan, I think two votes per precinct or three, whatever the equation was. This doesn't take much to move the needle. So if you have even a small sliver of the voting population who's turned off by the VP or excited by the VP choice, that's going to be critical. And I think we're seeing that with J.D. Vance, right? I mean, the backlash against him, despite Trump's weak efforts to defend him before the NABJ today, Vance is a drag on that ticket. And I think it's going to hurt him based on some just anecdotal exchanges I've had with people who want to vote for Trump.
You've had anecdotal exchanges with people who want to vote for Trump? You, Marge Halperin, have had anecdotal exchanges with people who want to vote for Trump?
Yeah, you know.
Who are these people?
They're high school classmates. I came from a apparently rather conservative place. But yeah, I had an exchange the other day on Facebook where somebody was pushing back on the, you know, you think Trump and Vance are weird, you know, and I said, yeah, he's weird. Look at what he says about women. And I, you know, bulleted all the things. And a woman who I don't know answered back and said, I need to see the receipts on that, you know, and I gave her a link instantly. I said, Google it. She said, if that were true, Trump wouldn't have put him on the ticket. She has no idea that he said these things about women or what he wants to give childless women fewer votes than women who have children. He wants to punish women who cross the border from red states in order to get an abortion in a blue state. I gave her a little litany, a short list. There were many more, and she'd never heard it.
I'm enjoying the Olympics, and I was a little disappointed with parts of the opening ceremony. I was perplexed by some of it. I was overwhelmed in a good way by parts of it. It was a mishmash, but I was never offended. And when then I was told to go back and watch the part that seemed to depict the Last Supper, I realized that I had actually seen that in real time and didn't get it. I didn't get that it was the Last Supper. I sure as hell didn't get that it was Dionysus. I think I'm saying that right. I was just, to be honest with you, I was just like, I really don't see the relevance of this. But then again, at the end of the day, it's French culture. This is how they present themselves to the world. It's their call. So you want to put a nude blue guy up there? Okay. Again, some of it I thought was spectacular, and some of it I thought was weird. I was never offended.
Now, first, I have to admit that I did not watch any of it originally because I absolutely don't care about the Olympics.
Wow.
So that's a whole nother topic.
That's even worse than not being a Christian.
Because everybody was so head up about the whole thing, I went and tried to find it.
That's what I did.
Online.
I went back and looked again.
Yeah. And I actually was never able to find a video clip of that section. I've really only seen very short bits of it or still pictures of it.
Yeah.
What amazed me was all the really cool parts of the opener that I never heard anything about. Like Lady Gaga's performance
was
awesome. Wonderful.
It was so fun.
Anyone who didn't see that, just put that, type that into Google, Lady Gaga Olympics. So there are a lot of really wonderful portions to it. And then apparently this thing where, I will say this. I do think it did reference the Last Supper. You did clearly have that entire imagery going on there for a little while. And just for, I guess, I'm not sure if we really described it yet, right? So for the listeners who don't recall yet, the centerpiece included a woman with a large round gold halo sort of thing. And then apparently all the people spread along the table were drag queens. And eventually
they did a fashion show.
They did a fashion show. And then eventually on the table, when they lifted the lid off of a plate, it was a man completely, you know, made up in like Blue Man Group makeup.
Yep.
Who was supposed to be the Greek god Dionysius. So it was a very bizarre, very French thing. Just like you said, John, it was so French. So, yeah, I was not offended. I'm an atheist, culturally a Catholic, Catholic school for 12 years. I have a pretty good idea, I feel like, of what would offend my Catholic, still very Catholic relatives. They pretty much would just laugh at something like this. I don't think it's fair to claim that it was not supposed to be a reference to the Last Supper.
Well, who gets to decide that? That's interesting because I wrote the word reference. You said it looks as though it did reference the Last Supper. I think that's different than appeared similar to. Reference, I think, connotes intent. And I don't. And the artistic designer said that was not my intent.
The rap originally reported a statement from the producers saying that he had been inspired by the Last Supper. And I know he later came out and said he wasn't. Who knows?
I don't think that question is in play.
I just don't know how you have that set up. Without understanding that it looks like I get that.
Like if I were in the room, I would say, oh boy, I don't know who Dionysus is. I can't even pronounce it. But this looks like the Last Supper. So, but then the question would be for the producers or the artistic designers of this thing. Okay, do you care what people in Illinois think? Because we're in France and this is French. So shut up if you don't get, like, even if they anticipated the blowback that they're getting here in the Midwest. And by the way, it's not just in the Midwest. Maybe they would do it anyway.
How widespread was it, John?
Somebody in Istanbul was protesting, but it was just a guy with a sign. I don't know.
Don't you remember when Trump was president, there was a drawing that went around that depicted him in Jesus' seat in a Last Supper scenario?
There's a bunch of
there
them.
There was no couching that. They meant it. They meant to depict him as Jesus in the middle of the table with his own disciples. And there was no outrage that I recall.
That was from the Republicans. That was not supposed to be making
fun. That was theirs. That's right. That was theirs. They were honoring him by putting him in Jesus' seat. So they didn't complain that that was sacrilegious.
Oh, wait a minute. But the distinction that I think Kate is making is that it's okay to do it as long as you're not mocking a ceremony. It's okay to put Trump in the center where Tony Soprano sat, for instance, when they did their version of that, or where Charlie Brown sat when they did the Peanuts version of that, or when they did the Lost TV show version of that. There's been a million of these, but I guess it's...
Yeah. I wasn't clear if it was someone who was mocking Trump in some sort of editorial cartoon, or if it was something his own people were putting forward.
Oh.
I mean, I think if you're really devout and you're going to be offended by this type of thing, you should be offended by either.
Then you also shouldn't have a TV.
But I just wondered.
Because the whole world.
Be offended to begin with.
But I think they were not offended. Those same people passed it around and cheered it. Loved seeing Trump in Christ's seat, but now let the French do some kind of different sort of parody with drag queens and their outrage. So they get to choose how to cast aspersions on religious imagery, but nobody else does.
But again, it wasn't. I'm sorry, Kate. I don't and Marge believe. In fact, the director said, you know, why on earth would I do that? What's the upside of offending Christians around the globe? And then somebody else sent me a note and it said, by the way, it's wildly off topic. The depiction of that Last Supper is not French. The original is in a museum in Italy and it doesn't have anything to do with the games. So that's not even on topic.
Yeah. Well, when you're filming things with a lot of characters at a dinner table, I mean, it's the same reason the Last Supper is painted like it is. Everybody has to be on one side so the camera sees all of the faces. So any kind of setting like that is going to be evocative of the Last Supper, I think. But opening ceremonies of the Olympics are always so weird. Like every year, they're really weird. They're like militaristic and fascistic sometimes. Other times, they're just kind of like it's very wacky. The good things about the Olympics opening ceremony are you see all the outfits that the people from the different countries wear, and then maybe you get a good musical performance. And we got Celine Dion was also incredible.
Amazing.
And those two things were good. And then I would just like just assume the rest of the Olympic ceremony is like meandering and plodding along. And, you know, like you have to look at like 50 different French athletes that you've never heard of carry the torch forever, and it's most of it is silly, so we should expect silliness.
Yeah,
lighting the cauldron was a highlight, raising it up in the big balloon. I thought that was glorious. There are a lot of great points. You aren't going to like every minute of it, but I feel like the party of Trump, just like Trump, is living this aggrieved life. And they're just looking for examples of how they could be further aggrieved.
Kate's right, though. If you Google Lady Gaga and Olympics, that musical performance is so much fun. And it made me wonder where they got that. And I thought I'd recognize that tune just a little bit. So we went back and posted it at WGNradio.com on my page, the original version of that from the Ed Sullivan Show in 1965, where a French woman in a black leotard who was a ballet dancer and an actress did that song with the other people doing the fan dance around her. And the choreography, and it's a 5-minute presentation on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it is so fun and inventive. You know, if you just think about all of the technology that has to go into mics and cameras along a 3.5-mile long river, and everything is queued up. You hit the mic. Is that mic had better be on? What button do we hit for that? Now we got to go to the other venue. Now we got to cut to another thing. What a lot of work that was. And by and large, they pulled it off. I wish they had had some towels for the cameras so that when they would focus in on something, it would immediately blur because of the raindrops. I'm like, dude, wipe off the camera. Come on. We can't see.
I think it was really pouring.
Oh, gosh, what a mess. And now it's like 95 degrees in humid. So they're getting the worst of all weather there. And Americans are doing well. One last note. It is nice to see Simone Biles and the U.S. women's gymnastic team do as well as they're doing. Not just because they're Americans and we root for America, but I was happy to see her be able to get over whatever got her 4 years ago. That's a nice story, too, isn't it? And there's so many of those. We always get wrapped up in our anger about something like the Last Supper at the Olympics. And if you just take a breath, there's some really spectacular things going on there.
Suni Lee, she had an amazing story. She was hospitalized, 2 different kidney ailments. I don't even know. They didn't say what they were, where they thought she, you know, would never be able to train again, much less perform and compete. They all, and throughout the countries, there were many lovely stories. And that's one thing that I think I really enjoy. I like the sport, but I also love the personalized stories that you get to learn about the different athletes and what they go through to get where they are. That's part of the emotion of the whole thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry, Kate. I think it's really lovely. Try again. You might change your mind.
I don't know that we need to spend much time on the Dexter Reed story, that the police are now saying that the reason he was pulled over was because of the tinted windows, not because he didn't have a seatbelt on.
I have a question about that, though, John. What happens to the police reports that were filed saying they pulled him over because of seatbelt? They were false reports, and are they going to be disciplined? As we knew from the beginning, they were false, but now the lawyers are putting a better spin on it to protect the I don't understand how they can change the story when the police reports as filed say something different, and what are the repercussions of that? Doesn't the case fall apart if the police don't have the credibility in their own reports? Well, Austin might know more about that definitely than I do.
Yeah, it's not clear to me why at this point in the process that information is coming out rather than earlier. And it makes me think of the entire rollout of some of the details of this, I think, has been contentious throughout. And I know that the head of COPPA has received pushback from that, but I would just say that in cases like this, the more orderly and transparent and complete the release of information can be, the better. When there's bits of information leaking out or incomplete investigations coming out beforehand, I'm not saying we should take, you know, a year to figure out everything that happened, but more clarity around the process and timing of these investigations, I think, is very much warranted. And Los Angeles is a fantastic example of this. You could go to a Los Angeles equivalent of a COPPA committee meeting every single month. Sometimes they're weekly. They're all live streamed on Zoom. Evidence is presented. It's all very open. And it's just a much better system than what we seem to have here.
The first week and even the first couple of weeks that this story happened and we were discussing it, you guys might recall, it was very confusing because the officers had not been interviewed yet. So we were being told that Dexter Reed had been pulled over for lack of a seatbelt, but we didn't understand where that information was coming from because the officers had supposedly not yet been interviewed. So where were they getting that from? We never really got an answer on that early on. So it's going to be very interesting, certainly in the coming weeks, to see how this shakes out, where these conflicting stories have come from.
Either way, though, it did seem like, for whatever reason, he was pulled over. Was it the seatbelt or was it the tinted windows? You know, the reason we're talking about it all is because they fired upon him so many times and it did not seem to be necessary. The new fact that we have here is that they say that they pulled him over not for tinted windows, or not for not wearing a seatbelt, but for tinted windows. None of that changes the fact that what happened afterwards was just overreach. They shouldn't have handled that pulling him over the way they did, is the point. You know, Austin, as you were saying, though, that it's better if, rather than letting facts just trickle out, let's have a more comprehensive presentation of the evidence, do the investigation, and then reveal it, but in a timely manner. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just when this was in March, the traffic stop was March 21st, I want to say.
Yeah.
This situation is not that complicated that we can't have a full, you know, presentation of the facts in this case by now. It's not, I mean, it happened over the course of maybe half an hour. And there was, you know, fewer than 10 people there. So we have a lot of the body cam footage. We have audio from that. We have the documentation of the officers after the fact. That should all be published in a much more timely manner than what we're seeing.
Did you, you know, this just makes me think a little bit about Josh Hawley, the rest of the senators that were grilling the now acting head of the Secret Service, because he was saying, we're trying to figure out what happened. And I don't know why it's taking them so long, but the grandstanding that the senators did, where rather than let the guy explain the process and why he hasn't fired more people yet, they weren't interested in his answer. They were just yelling at this dude. And those sort of Senate hearings are always performative that way, but it was so frustrating to watch that go down. And I'm like, you guys aren't, this is not a fact-finding mission here, is it? This is because it's bipartisan. Nobody is standing up for what happened. It was clearly a failure. Even the Secret Service says it's a failure. The only purpose of that hearing was to yell at those guys for public consumption.
They just want people to be fired. I would have turned to him and said, who should I fire? Can you name the person who's responsible? Because we need to investigate to find out.
Right. On the ground that day, whose responsibility was it?
Who was there? There's some local police people. There were the FBI, the Secret Service. There are a lot of groups involved. There was some last minute communication in between. Yeah. There was the officer who went up to look at the perpetrator and went up on the roof. And the guy pointed his gun at him, and so he dropped to the bottom. Was he supposed to do something else? You're going to fire him because he didn't carry his gun up there? Or, I understand you need a little time to investigate. And unlike the Derek Reed situation, there are a lot of people to talk to gather the information.
And the buck
and
stops.
They wouldn't have it.
The buck stops at the top. Like the director of the Secret Service should be fired. I have
and
no.
She's gone.
Or sure, she quit. But anyway, but that doesn't mean that she was the person that was casing the venue beforehand. Who were the boots on the ground? Those are the people that that had a failure here. So who are those people?
And who established the perimeter, which apparently overlooked a pretty key spot.
I'm on a tangent now. Let's go back to Chicago for a second. Here's another headline, Brandon. What do I need to know about this, Brandon? Austin. Here's another headline, Austin. Mayor Brandon Johnson's political campaign paid a firm for fundraising while it lobbied City Hall, spurring calls for reform. It's Alice Yin's story in the Tribune. What do I need to know about this one?
Well, first of all, a great story by Alice Yin, and I think Gregory Royal Pratt contributed on that as well. But it showed that Mayor Brandon Johnson's campaign was paying a public affairs firm called the Mercury Public Affairs to help with his political fundraising, while at the same time, that firm was getting paid to lobby the mayor's office for official action. So Mercury Public Affairs has in the past lobbied the mayor's office, and this is publicly disclosed, on things like the government-owned grocery store that we had talked about several months ago, for a guaranteed income pilot program that we've discussed a lot, while they were working as a paid consultant to help the mayor raise money. So this raised concerns of ethics experts. The campaign, Brandon Johnson's campaign, refused to talk about it. Former University of Illinois Chicago professor Dick Simpson raised concerns about it from an ethics perspective. And I think it was just the lack of seriousness in addressing that. I mean, the mayor would not comment on it at all, is reflective of what is becoming concerning in this administration, is just a complete lack of regard for any kind of ethics reform, even in the face of things like Ed Burke's sentencing and other high profile corruption stories. We had several months ago, Alderman Matt Martin on the north side introduce an ordinance that would essentially just close a loophole that would allow the city to punish lobbyists who contributed to mayoral campaigns. That's a law that's already on the books, but because of a loophole, it can't be enforced. And Brandon Johnson refused to let that through city council. And his excuse was, you know, we need to have a comprehensive public financing of campaigns. And until we get that, I mean, I'm not going to do this, which just in a city like Chicago, it just rings so hollow that you wouldn't take a substantial yet marginal win on ethics reform because you want something that is a much less passive, much lower chance of passing.
Mm-hmm. Explain the conflict of interest here, though. You have this New York City-based political strategy firm, that's Mercury Public Affairs. Just put your finger again on the conflict.
So say I'm the mayor's office and I'm hiring someone to help me raise money for my campaign. And that person says, yes, we will help you raise money for your campaign.
Which campaign?
His mayoral campaign.
So get me
more money for my campaign.
When I run again. Campaign. Okay, fine.
And Mercury, you're gonna help me. And Mercury says, yes, great. We will help you with that. By the way, let me introduce you to a couple of my friends who are also paying me to advance lobbying causes for you. Mm-hmm. That's the inherent conflict of interest there. It's the same thing as a lobbyist donating directly a ton of money to a campaign.
I've been in Chicago too long. You needed to explain that to me and why that's a bad thing.
Yeah. You know, the thing that I was surprised by is that one of the co-owners or co-leaders of Mercury, Susie Wiles, she was a strategist for Trump's campaign. Oddly, also DeSantis. And then she must have come over to Trump after something in 2020. Do they even know people who would give money to Brandon Johnson? I was surprised.
Those affairs, I'm sure you guys have worked with them. I mean, the biggest ones, and Mercury is definitely big, their business models, they're hiring. Those partners are, you have some huge person in strings in the Republican administration, some person who has a huge strings to pull in a Democrat administration. That way you don't have a down year. You're making money no matter who's
not. You can do it all. Hmm. Yep.
And then the other story, Chicago Teachers Union seeks to reduce property tax bill for West Loop headquarters. I think I might be able to understand this one. But Austin, just do again for us what you did a moment ago.
So right now, the Chicago Teachers Union is in contract negotiations, and they've been increasingly combative towards not only Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez, but also J.B. Pritzker, and specifically President Stacey Davis Gates has been saying more and more bombastic things about the governor because they want the governor to give more than $1 billion extra to Chicago public schools. CTU has been advocating for more tax hikes in city council. And while at the same time they're doing that, they are saying that they're paying too much in property taxes on their headquarters in the West Loop, according to documents that we found. So they're market value that they were paying taxes on that property was around $10 million, according to the assessor. When it was reassessed, that market value exploded to $19 million. And the Chicago Teachers Union is saying, no, it's actually worth $9 million. So they would be saving more than $500,000 on their property tax bill that would be paid by other people around the city. And that includes over $250,000 that would go to Chicago Public Schools. So that was another example of sort of hypocrisy from the union. They've done the same thing on school choice, where the union president sending her own child to a private school while they were advocating against school choice for other people. But the interesting wrinkle here is the people, and this is just like, I don't know why you would do this. This is such an unforced error. They hired Ed Burke's old law firm to do the property tax appeal. KBC Law Group, formerly Clafter and Burke. And that's who the Chicago Teachers Union is paying to get their property tax bill lowered.
Couldn't they have hired Pat Quinn? isn't his firm.
He hired anyone else.
There were plenty of others. Yeah.
Well, Burke was good at that, though. I mean, maybe they don't care what the optics are. By golly, we want to get the tax, the valuation reduced so the taxes go down. What is the fair market value of that property, though, right? That's the question. Is how do we, why did it go up, for instance? Was it all previously?
Partially, it's in the West. It's in a highly desirable area. I mean, they bought in the West Loop this property and really built it out for their headquarters after they sold the. They were able to buy that because they sold a tower they formerly owned, which was supposed to be affordable housing for teachers. It's called Fuchs Tower in the Gold Coast. They sold that for many millions of dollars and then bought this West Loop property. So the value has definitely gone up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's gone from $10 million to $19 million in a year, but it certainly hasn't gone in the last year from being worth $10 million to $9 million, which is what the union is claiming in this appeal.
Well, I guess the real crime will be then what happens next, right? I mean, you can appeal anything you want. The question is, are they going to get away with it? Is the mayor going to help them out on this? Is that the suggestion here or implication?
I don't think necessarily the mayor will help them out, but the assessor's office should get back to them, we're told, this week, and then they can decide whether to appeal again to try to reduce that bill. But I just think given that they are the largest political spender in the city, and the largest advocate for revenue increases, it's not a great look to be saying, yeah, taxes should be higher, but not on us.
Maybe so, but you are no fan of the CTU and Stacey Davis Gates. If in fact you are being unfairly assessed, and I take your point that I'm sure it didn't go down, but we need all the revenue we can, but nobody should pay unfairly. Nobody should pay more than their fair share, right?
I would agree with that. Yes. And I don't, it's not illegal for them to try to get a property tax break. I'm just saying maybe they should extend that same grace and understanding to other people who don't want to pay higher taxes.
Boy,
I don't know that they're opposed to anybody else challenging their property taxes. And in fact, I think those of us who have lived a long time in Chicago know that given the assessment system over decades, many decades, it's really wise to challenge it every time.
Yeah.
You know, and you sometimes you win, sometimes you don't. I've challenged my home taxes repeatedly since I worked for Pat Quinn years ago and learned about the system. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think they're saying they don't want to pay more taxes. That is, if the tax rate went up, they would pay it. I don't think they said raise property taxes on everybody but us. So I think you've twisted the message a little bit to my ear, Austin.
But they are, every dollar they save, I mean, is made up from other people. It's not as though that money just goes away. The fact that the rhetoric is all about paying fair share, wealthy organizations paying more, they can afford to pay more. It's a $30 million a year organization, but yet they're not. And if I was the head of the CTU, would I appeal my property tax bill? Probably yes. But at the same time, I would not be saying the same sort of rhetoric about how wealthy property owners are not paying high enough taxes.
They bought in the wrong neighborhood if they didn't want to pay higher property taxes. I wonder if they realized what was going to happen over there, because not that long ago, that was not a hot area in the city. But in the last 4 or 5 years, maybe 3 or 4 years, the West Loop is just, it's insane. And then there they are, wishing that the property values weren't going up so much. Is that it?
Well, to be clear, they're not right in the West Loop. They're like 1900 West. They're like Damon, and they're on Carroll Street. They're it's a very industrial area where people were buying up big warehouses. There are a lot of theater companies out there that use them as stage workshops and that kind of thing. Gentrification is creeping in and values are going up. They might not have foreseen how quickly.
Everyone's got a right to absolutely appeal their property taxes. And I think you're right, Marge. It's almost an automatic thing that you just should do it. It's just like good business. Appeal your business, your taxes.
Yep.
But when you are not just saying my property didn't increase in value by $9 million, but you're claiming it decreased in value in an area that has clearly skyrocketed in value, that's a little disingenuous. And it's legal, but you can't really complain if people point out that it's hypocritical. It's a bad look.
Is it a bargaining thing? Like, do you come in at 9 and therefore hope to get, you know, 14 instead of 16? Or, you know, I don't, I have, when I said I appeal every year, I have some lawyer who, you know, one of these firms that does it for a percentage of the savings and all that. So I don't know, but I think that you shoot as low as you can and then you know it will go back up. But in this case, it, I agree with you. It's not a great look, but it's a strategy.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Eric Zorn, I believe, is going to join us next week. And hopefully Pete's saying no. He's still on Mincing Rascals vacation. He's got one more week away. Okay, fair enough. And hopefully we'll wrangle Brandon back in here sometime soon. But it's always good to talk to Marge Halperin, Kate Plies, and Austin Berg. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. Toodles.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.